Again, thank you to the organizers for inviting me here. I'm going to be talking about, in some sense, the monomial version of Jessica's talk. So most of this talk is going to be joint work in a paper with Baron Sternfels. The secant bodies part and the symbolic powers part is new work that I've been working on this summer. All right, so I'm just going to... The main thrust of this talk, again, is going to be talking about really secant varieties in a very combinatorial context. And so before I really get to all of that, I'm going to kind of give a review of secant varieties, introduction, even though I guess we just heard that in Jessica's talk. But it's going to be kind of a whirlwind introduction to secant varieties. Okay, so if I have two projective varieties inside of n-1 dimensional space, you can compute their embedded join, which is the variety you get by taking a point on x, a point on y, looking at the line spanned by those, taking the union of all lines you get that way, and then taking the Zariski closure of that. And if you take the join of a variety with itself, that's usually just called the secant variety, which I denote by the square, the secant square, and if you do the join with the variety, say, r times, then that's the rth secant variety. So typical questions you might like to answer about these varieties, really the one that I care the most about in some sense is the first one, that is, if I know the ideal for the variety, is it possible to figure out the ideal for some of the secant varieties? That's kind of motivated by applications in statistics. And a lot of times you can't really answer that question, so you might content yourself to know other things like the dimension. That's something that's been studied a lot about secant varieties, and sort of more recently with Jessica and David Cox's work about the degree. You might also investigate that invariance, but I'm going to focus mostly on the ideal question. So let me just give the sort of standard example, and one that has a lot of combinatorial flavor. I'll come back to it at the end, and this is the Segre embedding. So the Segre embedding, that's well, it's really just the projectivization of the set of all rank one generic m by n matrices, and so we all sort of know what the ideal is, or it's relatively easy to show that the ideal of this variety is just generated by the 2x2 minors of a generic matrix, and it's also, you know, just elementary linear algebra that the rth secant variety just consists of the projectivization of all matrices that have rank less than or equal to r. Now, it's a bit harder to show, though it's sort of also, I don't know, more or less well known, that the ideal of the secant variety is generated by the r plus 1 by r plus 1 minors of a generic matrix. And just to illustrate sort of a typical question about why the dimension, studying the dimension is an interesting thing to do and why there's a lot of focus on it, is because there's sort of an expected dimension that you get by kind of counting the parameters in the description of the secant variety. But many naturally occurring varieties, like the Segre variety, their secant varieties don't have the expected dimension. We like to sort of determine when that happens and why. So the dimension count that you do in this case is, well, the R-fold secant variety is specified by picking R points on that variety. So since the dimension of the Segre variety is m plus n minus 2, that gives you this many parameters in choosing those points, and then you pick a point on the plane spanned by those points, so that gives you a choice of r minus 1 parameters. So the expected dimension is this number, but the actual dimension of this variety, which you can also do get in a kind of elementary way, is this. And the elementary argument you get for this number is that, well, a matrix of rank R is determined by specifying, say, you can pick the first R rows of the matrix in any way you want, so that gives you R times N choices, and then the remaining M minus R rows of the matrix are gotten by taking linear combinations of the first R rows of the matrix, so that gives you a choice of this many parameters, and then there's a minus one because the projective variety, so you get that, you get this as the actual dimension. Well, you have to rigorize the argument I just gave, but you can. And so this is a variety that has some interesting defect where the actual dimension of the secant variety is not the one you expect. Okay, another thing, so a really combinatorial thing that happens in this case, is that it's sort of well known that this ideal, it's generated by the R plus 1 by R plus 1 minors, but they also form a Grobner basis for this ideal. And the typical proof of this statement depends on the RSK correspondence. And so I'm going to give a different proof later on. All right. So you might wonder why should you study secant varieties? So here are some possible motivations. So I guess for me, because I'm supposed to be representing statistics here, the reason that I find secant varieties interesting is they come up in many different statistical contexts. So the sort of the simplest one is what are called mixture models. And what's a mixture model? Well, it is a secant variety. I mean, that's just, it's more or less the definition from statistics. But they also come up in other contexts. So, for example, there are what are called phylogenetic models, and there are a number of theorems about these phylogenetic models where you can reduce the computation of the ideal to a certain base case. And there's theorems by Allman and Rhodes, and there's a theorem by Marta Castaneas and myself. And that base case turns out to be a secant variety in general. So it sort of comes up in this biological context. And also there's another case where it comes up in the study of Gaussian random variables called factor analysis. And anyways, you get some interesting secant varieties in many different statistical contexts. It's one reason that that from some recent, another reason for recent interest in secant varieties comes from the fact that it's related to matrix multiplication. So if you can prove something about the secant varieties of Segre embeddings, where you have multiple copies of PN, you can say something about how fast it's possible to multiply two matrices together. And I guess the algebraic geometry reason is just that lots of cool things happen when you start studying secant varieties, and there's and also you guys have seen this talk, lots of interesting combinatorics comes up. Okay, so that was my crash course on secant varieties. So let me give you the crash course on symbolic powers now. So we probably all learned about symbolic powers from chapter 3 in Eisenbud, and then subsequently forgot about them. So here's the reminder. So this is the commutative algebra definition, really. If you have an ideal, the symbolic power is just the sort of primary component, the natural primary component associated with the regular power of the ideal. And the way you make that precise is you say, well, you take the power of the ideal and then you localize at, I guess, the complement of the minimal prime, so you invert the complement of the minimal primes of this ideal, and then intersect back with the original polynomial ring, and that ideal is the symbolic power. Now, I'm not going to use that definition in this talk. I prefer this other definition, which is the so-called, the differential power, which is related to prolongations from Jessica's talk. So the differential power of an ideal is you take all polynomials that have the property that if you look at all derivatives of order less than or equal to r of that polynomial, they should all belong to the original ideal I. Okay? So, good. And the sort of fundamental theorem of Zariski and Nagata says that, well, in fact, if you have a radical ideal in a polynomial ring of characteristic zero, then maybe you need algebraically closed too, then the symbolic power equals the differential power. So I'm going to use the differential power definition. It's a little more, well, it's a little more down to earth, and also you can say lots of nice things about differential powers that you can't say about symbolic powers, because you might notice from this definition that if I had embedded primes, the symbolic power just strips those embedded primes away. So, but the differential power doesn't do that. So, okay. So the sort of standard example that you may have seen, for example, in Eisenbud, is that if you look at the ideal of 2x2 minors of a generic matrix that we saw two slides back, its symbolic power has a very nice description. It's generated by all products of minors of the generic matrix that satisfy this condition on the degrees of those minors. The sum of the degrees minus one should be equal to R, which is the order of the symbolic power that you're taking. And also there's this nice combinatorial commutative algebra statement, which is that in fact these natural product of minors form a Grobner basis for this symbolic power. Okay. So, yeah.
I'm not sure you said it. Zariski and Nagata
is characteristic zero. I think you need algebraically closed as well. The differential power kind of doesn't make so much sense you have to do divided powers, I guess. Okay. Yeah, I think this, at least the statement in Eisenbud is only for characteristic zero. Okay. Okay, so why, as a statistician, am I interested in symbolic power as well? Okay, that's a little harder to justify, but here's the kind of the answer. So the first is, there's this result of Cavallaro-Johnson that says that if you're in the case of, if you have a variety that's non-degenerate, which just means it's not contained inside any linear space, inside of projective space, then the ideal of the secant variety is contained in the symbolic power of the ideal of the variety. And there's this much nicer, stronger theorem. I'm stating it a little differently from the way Jessica stated it, but essentially it says that there's a certain graded piece of the ideal of the secant variety that's equal to the same graded piece of the symbolic power, the differential power. Of course, the other reason to study this, you know, for the people in this audience is that, well, it's going to lead to nice algebra and combinatorics. Okay. All right. So those are my introduction to secant varieties and symbolic powers, and now I'm going to start making things really combinatorial, and I'm going to focus on the case of monomial ideals. All right. Okay, so throughout this talk, I'm going to stick to the case of that my underlying field has characteristic zero and that's algebraically closed, though some of the statements go through to characteristic P, and some of them don't require algebraically closed at all. But you should, it's just, I don't want to have all the technicalities in the statements. Okay, so I and J, for the moment, are just two ideals, arbitrary ideals in the polynomial ring. X to the alpha is the usual monomial notation. So I'm going to stop talking about the varieties and just do everything on a level of ideals now. So I'm going to define the join now of just two ideals, and is this commutative algebra operation. So what you do, I have this ideal I and J in the polynomial ring and N indeterminates, and to compute the join ideal I star J, I take the ideal I and I plug in for the x variables y1 up to yn, and I take the ideal J and I plug in for the x variables z1 up to zn. Okay, I take the sum of those two ideals and then I add this linear ideal which says that xi equals yi plus zi. So I have this ideal in 3n indeterminants and I intersect back with the ring in the x's and in n indeterminants. And that's the definition of the join. And the reason why this corresponds to the usual definition of the join in a case where I and J are, say, radical ideals is that, a polynomial belongs to the join if and only if when you plug in for the variables y1 plus c1, you plug in the variables x1 up to xn, you plug in y1 plus c1. Up to yn plus zn, that should belong to the ideal I of y plus j of z. And the reason why that corresponds to the join is that this ideal is the ideal of what's called the abstract join. And this map of taking the sum is just the usual, addition map that goes from the abstract join to the embedded join. Okay, but I'm going to use this description a fair amount. Okay, so now let's focus on the case of monomial ideals, and let's ask the question, what does the join of two monomial ideals look like? So first off, it's relatively easy to show that if you have two monomial ideals, a join is a monomial ideal. And so now the question is, well, when does a particular monomial belong to that join or not? And, so let's just do it. So x to the alpha should belong to the join if, well, I plug in, y plus z, yi plus zi for each of the xi, and I expand that. I want this big polynomial to belong to I of y plus j of z. Now, since I and j are monomial ideals, that means that each of the monomials that appears over here, either the y part belongs to the I of y, or the z part belongs to j of z. Now, this statement is much easier to say in the converse, that is to say, what monomials don't belong to the join. And they're precisely a monomials not in the join if and only if it can be written as the product of two monomials where, say, x to the beta times x to the gamma, where x to the beta is not an I and x to the gamma is not a j. So the standard monomials of the join are the products of the standard monomials of I and j. Okay, so that actually leads to a very important, a very useful computational statement, which you can implement in Macaulay 2. So anyways, here's just an example of the statement, sort of the geometric picture to have in mind. So here are two ideals and two indeterminates, and so I've done the staircase diagrams, and the set of standard monomials of the join is just going to be the Minkowski sum of this set of standard monomials here and here, like this. Okay, but on the computational level, what this implies is that there's a certain duality between computing the join of ideals and multiplying ideals together, at least in the monomial case. So the precise statement you get is that you can compute this join by computing the Alexander dual of the original ideals, multiplying them, and then dualizing back. But it's a little technical exactly what you have to do because there's this you have to throw away some of the generators you get when you dualize back. And you have to choose that. So Alexander duality depends on taking a certain exponent vector, and you have to carefully choose the exponent vector. You just have to choose it large, large enough. But anyway, so if you don't know what Alexander duality is, it's essentially taking a staircase diagram and turning it upside down. Okay. And this theorem is, besides being sort of a nice, surprising duality between taking joins and multiplying ideals, this result really allowed us to prove all the results that have come later because we computed a lot of examples and noticed the patterns that emerged. Okay, so to make things really combinatorial, let's start to reduce to even more combinatorial monomial ideals. So, it's pretty easy to show that if, just in general, if you have two radical ideals, then their join is radical. That probably requires characteristic zero and algebraically closed. Yeah, that requires algebraically closed. I'm gonna focus on the square free monomial ideals, and of course we have this Stanley Reasoner correspondence, which says that square free monomial ideals correspond to simplicial complexes. So and the correspondence is that a subset of the n element set is a face of the simplicial complex if and only if the corresponding monomial is a standard monomial of that square free monomial ideal. Okay, so you have this correspondence. And so what the previous the proposition that I had up before, this one, implies is that then you get a sort of nice combinatorial operation on simplicial complexes when you compute the join of two square free monomial ideals. The combinatorial operation you get is I don't know, the join of the simplicial complexes, which is just the set of faces of the join simplicial complex, which is the union of one face from delta and one face from gamma. So, for example, if my underlying simplicial complex is this one here, one isolated vertex and two edges, its secant simplicial complex consists of, well, I take the union of these two edges and that gives me this solid tetrahedron, 2, 3, 4, 5, and the union of this vertex and this edge is 1, 2, 5, and then there's another triangle. Those are the facets of the simplicial complex. Okay. So now I want to I'm going to reduce even more from square free monomial ideals to what are called edge ideals. So, and then we're really going to start to see some combinatorics popping out. So if I have a graph whose vertex set is the set 1, 2, up to n, the edge ideal is just the square free quadratic monomial ideal that's generated by the pairs xi, xj, where ij is an edge of that graph. And one thing that's really nice is that the generators of the secant ideal, it will turn out, have a very nice combinatorial description in terms of the graph. So the sort of lead up to that is this proposition, which is that a graph has an R coloring if and only if its Rth secant is the zero ideal. So an R coloring is, you assign the numbers 1 up to R to the vertices of the graph such that adjacent vertices have different labels. So you can test for the chromatic number of a graph by just computing its secant ideals. And the first moment where you get the zero ideal, you know the chromatic number of the graph. let me just explain how the proof goes, because everything in this talk is really elementary. There's no like fancy algebra at all. So how does the proof go? Well, when is this the secant of an idea of a square-free monomial ideal, the zero ideal? Well, because the secant of a square-free monomial ideal is also a square-free monomial ideal, we just need to check whether or not this one monomial belongs to the ideal or not. So if this monomial, the product of all the variables, doesn't belong to the ideal, then it's the zero ideal. So that's straightforward. Okay, so now when does that monomial belong to the R secant ideal? Well, that happens if and only if you can write this monomial as the product of R monomials, each of which does not belong to the original edge ideal. And that's just the sort of R-fold generalization of that proposition about joins of monomial ideals I had before. Okay, so I've written this monomial as a product of R monomials that do not belong to the edge ideal. Okay, now when is a monomial, a square-free monomial, not in the edge ideal? Well, that's going to happen if and only if I look at the set of indices that appear in that monomial, that that set should belong to the simplicial complex associated to this edge ideal. Okay, and what are the sets associated? What are the faces of the simplicial complex associated with the edge ideal? They're precisely the independent sets of the graph, which are the set of vertices that have no edges between any of them. Okay. So at this point, what I have is I have a partition of the vertices of the graph into R disjoint independent sets. That's a coloring. That's just the definition of a coloring. Okay. So what that means is, sort of more generally, the generators of the secant ideals of edge ideals are going to tell us something about coloring properties of the underlying graph. So one little piece of notation. If I have a subset of the n-element set, m sub v is the monomial, the square-free monomial indexed by that subset of the n-element set, so the product of the variables indexed by that n-element set. And g sub v is the induced subgraph on that set of vertices. So that is, you take the subgraph whose vertex set is v, and where the edges, an edge appears if it only appeared in the original graph. So the generalization of the proposition on the previous slide is telling us something about what are the when are certain subgraphs are colorable. So the generators of this secant ideal of an edge ideal, they're precisely the subgraphs that are not R colorable. Okay. So another way of saying this is the generators of the secant ideal are the obstructions to coloring. So they're telling you something about how what's causing us not to be able to color the graph with few colors. Okay, so just as a very simple example, if I have a five cycle, here's the edge ideal. It has these five generators. And, of course, it's not too colorable because, you start trying to color it red, green, red, green, and then you get stuck on vertex 5. But every subgraph is too colorable. So the generator of the secant square is just the product of all the monomials. And since it's three colorable, then all higher secant ideals are zero. For a more complicated example, we take this triangular kind of graph. Well, of course, there are many obstructions to two coloring here. Any triangle is going to be a problem. So for every triangle in this graph, I'm going to have a generator of degree 3. that's obstructing the coloring, but there's also another obstruction of the coloring that's maybe less obvious, which is there's a 9 cycle that goes around the boundary that's not implied by any of those triangles in the graph. So when you compute the secant square of this idea, you get a bunch of generators of degree 3, and there's one generator of degree 9. Okay, so in Jessica's talk, we saw lots of examples where... Yes, that's a good question. Okay, so every 7 cycle, so for example, this 7 cycle, it has this triangle as an induced subgraph. So that 7 cycle, it is going to be in the ideal, but it's divisible by the monomial. So this is saying what all the square free monomials appearing in the ideal, but the minimal generators then will be the subgraphs that are not R colorable, but every induced subgraph is R colorable. Okay. So those 7 cycles happen to not have that property. Okay. Okay, so we saw in Jessica's talk that lots of kind of standard examples of secant varieties tend to be generated by polynomials in low degree. And it's sort of natural to ask in this setting if we can classify which graphs have the property that their secant ideals are generated in low degree. So the lowest possible degree for a minimal generator of an ideal that's generated in degree 2, of the secant of an ideal generated in degree 2 is degree R plus 1. So the question is, when do those minimal degree generators suffice for a graph? And it turns out that there's a very nice characterization of such graphs. So another way of saying that is, in this language of saying that the generators of the secant ideals are obstructions to coloring, the question is, when are the complete subgraphs the only obstructions to coloring? Okay, that class of graphs is well known in combinatorics. They're called the perfect graph. So this is the precise combinatorial definition of what a perfect graph is. It's just that the chromatic number of every induced subgraph is equal to the cardinality of the largest clique in that subgraph, the largest complete subgraph. But if you wanted, you could just take as the definition of a perfect graph, the ideals whose edge ideals are generated in degree R plus 1 for all R. There's really no content to this theorem once it's really just a corollary to the previous thing. Okay, so examples of perfect graphs. So there are lots of interesting examples of perfect graphs. So bipartite graphs are always perfect. And then there's a large class, which I'm going to use a lot a little later, which are the incomparability graphs of partially ordered sets. So if you have a partially ordered set, you can get 2 graphs out of that partially ordered set. So the comparability graph says, I'm going to put an edge between 2 elements of the Poe set if they are comparable. Okay. And the incomparability graph is just a complement of that. I put an edge if 2 elements are not comparable to each other. Okay. And those are both known to be classes of perfect graphs. Okay, so why is this interesting? Maybe you might ask yourself at this point. What's the point? So perfect graphs, they've been studied a lot in graph theory, but there's a very, I think, famous now theorem called the strong perfect graph theorem, which gives a type of characterization of the perfect graphs that in some, I don't know, I think it's probably one of the biggest combinatorics results in the past few years. It's gotten a lot of attention. It says what the minimal obstructions to being perfect are. There are really only 2 types of graphs that obstruct being perfect. They're the the odd holes, which are just cycles of odd length greater than 3, so like the 5 cycle that we saw before, and that 9 cycle around the boundary, and the complement of the odd hole. So the complement is just, you just take the edges that aren't in the original graph as your graph. So those are the only minimal obstructions to perfection. And that actually translates into and is equivalent to the sort of commutative algebra version of the strong perfect graph theorem. That's what CASPGT stands for. So the complement in a complete graph. So this is equivalent to the strong perfect graph theorem, but it works for arbitrary monomial ideals that are generated by quadrics. So you could also have, you know, xi squared as a generator. And it gives essentially a characterization of the ways that the secant ideals can fail to be generated in degree r plus 1. That is, you start computing the secant ideals and you look at the first place where you stop being generated in degree r plus 1. And there's a very precise ways that can happen. So the three ways that can happen are, well, okay, the first thing is you can just be perfect. So you're always generating a degree less than or equal to r plus 1. That's sort of the perfect case. And then you can either fail at the first step. You compute the secant square of the ideal. And in that case, there must be a minimal generator of odd degree strictly greater than 3. Or you don't fail at the first possibility. You're generating degree r. You're generating degree f plus 1 for a while, and in the first place where you stop being generating degree f plus 1, you only pick up a minimal generator in degree 2r plus 1. Okay, so it's a very. I wouldn't have suspected that something so strong could hold for the generators of the secant ideals. So, these two statements are equivalent. You might try to. So the proof of the strong perfect graph theorem is about 150 pages long, and it's very technical. You might, I don't know, try to prove the strong perfect graph theorem using commutative algebra or something. I don't know how that would go exactly, but I don't know, maybe. Commutative algebra has something to give to graph theory. Okay. All right, so let me... are there any questions maybe at this point? Yeah, so r plus 1, well, that's going to correspond to a clique of size r plus 1. But the 2r plus 1 says, well, of course, the first point you fail, that's going to have to be that there was a minimal subgraph that had a chromatic number s plus 1 sitting inside there. And what the strong perfect graph theorem says is, well, the only graphs that have that property must have 2r plus 1 vertices. There must be these particular graphs. So that's why you only get 2r plus 1. There's a theorem of Lovach that's a bit weaker, which would say that if you didn't know this theorem, it would say that the only possibilities are r plus 1, 2r plus 1, 3r plus 1, and so on. And the strong perfect graph theorem will let you drop off all those higher order cases. Okay. Okay, so now I want to talk about symbolic powers. And so again, you might be wondering why, you know, symbolic powers, I mean, do these topics really go together? And I think it's my feeling now, having worked on this project, that that these two topics just belong together. If you're going to study symbolic powers, you need to study secants too. And we're going to see that in a little bit. So I want to tell you what the symbolic powers of edge ideals look like. Now, of course, symbolic powers, they're never going to be radical ideals. So I can't just really characterize the square-free monomial generators, but, well, it turns out that there's a polarization argument. They differed from what Jessica meant when she said polarization, but there's a way to sort of get to the square-free case. So really, I'm just going to tell you what a square-free generators of the symbolic powers look like, and you can recover the general case. Okay, so I need, again, a graph theoretic definition. Tau of G is the cardinality of the smallest vertex cover of the graph. A vertex cover of the graph is a subset of the vertices such that every edge in the graph is incident to at least one of the vertices that set. And this is just the smallest vertex cover. Okay, so the theorem is that, well, the square free generators, at least, of the symbolic powers are precisely the obstructions to having a small vertex covering. Okay? So they're precisely the subgraphs that have a large covering number. And so, anyways, here's the proof is also, I don't know, relatively elementary. So when is a square free monomial in this symbolic power? Well, I should take, by the Zariski-Nagata theorem, because this is a radical ideal, that's equivalent to saying that all of these partial derivatives are in the original edge ideal. Okay, but that's equivalent to saying that if you take the induced subgraph GZ, so the only partial derivatives that aren't going to be zero are going to be the sort of square-free partial derivatives, because I'm taking the partial derivative of a square-free monomial. So, but the partial derivative of a square-free monomial ideal by a square-free differential operator is just what you just divide by the right corresponding monomial. And on the level of graphs, that's just saying pass to another induced subgraph. So this is equivalent to saying that, well, you want for every subset of this set V that has this cardinality, you look at the induced subgraph you get by removing the vertices F, and that subgraph shouldn't be the empty graph. There should be at least an edge, because that way the corresponding monomial will be in the edge ideal. Okay? And well, that's equivalent to saying that for all subsets that have this cardinality, this set S is not a vertex cover of the induced graph. Because if it were, you couldn't. If it were, well, okay, because there's an edge left over that isn't containing any of those vertices, right? So that sort of contradicts being a vertex cover, but that's precisely the same as saying that the covering number of this graph is greater than or equal to R. Okay, so again, the moral is that symbolic powers, they're tied to the combinatorial property of the underlying graph. And so again, the natural question to ask is, when are the symbolic powers generated in the sort of the simplest possible way? Now, they're not going to be generated in degree R plus 1, but they're sort of a natural structure to guess that they might be generated in a particular way that might be generated. Because, you by the Carlotto-Johnson theorem, you know that the secant ideal of any ideal, any ideal without linear forms, is contained in the differential power. And you also know that this sum of products of smaller symbolic powers is always contained in the symbolic power. So the sort of natural simplest possible generating set is just to say that, well, that containment is actually an equality. Okay, and I call that differentially perfect, and the reason perfect is sitting there is because of course, we're going to have the same type of theorem, which is that the edge ideal is differentially perfect if and only if the graph is a perfect graph. But the corollary is it really gives a very specific way to describe the generating set for the symbolic powers of an edge ideal of a perfect graph. They're generated by products of clicks, and those clicks have to satisfy this property, which is kind of, it should be, look similar to the degree formula we saw for the generators of the secant of the symbolic powers of the Segre ideal, the ideal of 2x2 minors. Okay. So again, you have this perfect graph coming up. The reason is slightly different than in the secant case. So it pretty much boils down to the fact that the complement of a minimal vertex cover is a independent set of the graph. And an independent set is a clique in the complementary graph. So this statement, though it looks very similar to the secant statement, it's actually coloring, you have to color the complementary graph, not the original graph. So it's a little different. Okay, and then if you really want to mix things up a bit, you can say, okay, well, we know how to do secants of edge ideals, and we know something about symbolic powers of edge ideals. So, what happens if we like do both at once? And the result is, well, I'm not going to. There's a class of graphs, which is a subset of the perfect graphs, where you can very easily describe the minimal generators of the symbolic power of the secant of the edge ideal. And it's also given as a product of clicks. And in the green graphs, there are sort of three kind of standard classes that sit in there. And the important one for us is going to be the incomparability graph of a post set. Okay, so I've been doing all this connections of graphs to secants and symbolic powers, but I started off the talk talking about some determinantal ideals, and so now I want to tell you how all of this graph stuff connects back to that example from the beginning. And let me leave that. So there's this result of Seamus and Ulrich. Actually, this was kind of the starting point for this project that Berend and I had, was this result. Take computing the initial ideal of an ideal, it doesn't commute, but it's relatively well behaved. So in particular, the initial ideal of the secant ideal is a sub ideal of the secant of the initial ideal. Okay, so we call a term order is called R delightful for the ideal if there's an equality, if that's actually an equality, and its term order is delightful if it's all R delightful for all R. This is a very Sternfeld kind of name for something, right? So this containment suggests a certain strategy for computing Grobner bases of secant ideals. And the strategy is this, the delightful strategy. So the first thing you do is you start with your ideal, and using some method, you figure out a nice description of an initial ideal with respect to some term order. And you figure out a combinatorial interpretation for that. So, for example, it might be an edge ideal. Then you use all this stuff about monomial ideals I've been talking about to figure out a description for the secant of the initial ideal. Then if you're very, very lucky, you can find a collection of you find a collection of polynomials G that's in the secant ideal that has the property that the initial terms of this set G actually generate the secant of the initial ideal. And then that implies the reverse containment. Right? That implies that the initial ideal of the secant of the initial ideal is a sub-ideal of the initial of the secant ideal. And thus, this collection of polynomials you have is a Grobner basis for the ideal with respect to the term order. So you found a delightful term order. And well, actually, this strategy works precisely the same for differential powers. You have the same containment, and there's the same, just replace squiggle bracket with angle bracket. Okay, so let me give you an example of how this works in practice. So I'm going to go back to this ideal of 2x2 minors and give you the simple, well, anyways, let's just do it. So I am in this ideal of 2x2 minors of a generic matrix, and the term order that I'm going to use is the sort of typical term order you use for talking about Grobner bases of determinantal ideals, which is the sort of main diagonal term order. So this is any term order that selects as the leading term the main diagonal of every minor of this matrix. So for example, lexicographic order across the rows is an example of such a term order. Okay, now, again, you use some method or other to show that in the case of the 2x2 minors, the initial ideal is just given by the initial terms of the 2x2 minors in this case. So I don't have nothing I said has a method for proving that. You have to do that on your own. Some other way, okay, but it's easy. Okay, and it turns out that in this case, the initial ideal, so it's an edge ideal, but it's also one of these incomparability edge ideals. So if I write down, let's say this is in the 4x5 case, if I write down this partially ordered set, which is just, you get by taking the matrix and kind of rotating it like this, then the generators of this ideal are precisely the two-element anti-chains in the graph. So they're precisely the incomparable pairs in the graph, okay, and in the post-set. And so that means that the corresponding edge ideal is, the corresponding graph is a perfect graph. So I know what the secants of this ideal are going to look like. They're going to be the cliques in that incomparability graph. But the cliques in the incomparability graph are precisely the anti-chains in the graph, so the incomparable elements. Okay. So that is the secant, the R minus 1 secant of this post-set ideal is just generated by all R element anti-chains in that post-set. Okay. All right, now then you just need to verify for yourself that, well, every R element anti-chain is the leading term of an R by R minor. Okay, so, you know, for example, if I had 1, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 3, 4, that's going to be the leading term of, the sub-matrix that has this column and these two columns there. Anyways, that's relatively straightforward to check. And then, well, by elementary linear algebra, the R by R minors belong to the R minus 1 secant ideal, okay? And then we're done. The term order is delightful and for this ideal. And thus, these R by R minors form a Grobner basis for the ideal of R by R minors, for this secant ideal. So, which, if you're familiar with the RSK proof, this is, I think, a much simpler proof than the RSK proof. And Berend also concurs with that statement. So, and actually, you get other corollaries, like these sort of commutative algebras.
Mm-hmm.
No, the Ulrich result is, that's, I don't know, graduate student exercise. It's very easy. Yeah, there's not, there, I don't know, it's, this is really, I can do it, so it must be really elementary. Okay, so yeah, everything is really elementary. The only, pardon? Yeah, it deals, but you have to develop the straightening law. That's the hard part of the RSK proof. And you don't have to deal with any of that messy combinatorics. The only unproven thing I have here is that incomparability graphs of posets are perfect. But that's a relatively easy theorem as well. Okay. Oh, another corollary you get is that the ideal of R by R minors is a prime ideal. And the reason that's true is that, well, again, you have to check the 2x2 case, but the 2x2 case is a toric ideal, so it's prime. And then secant ideals of prime ideals are prime in the algebraically closed case. Okay. And, well, okay, let's do some more corollaries. So, you actually get the Grobner bases for the symbolic powers, too, just as immediate corollary, because, the incomparability graphs of posets are green graphs, so we know that the generators are products, the generators of the symbolic powers of the secants are products of cliques, and the products of cliques are the initial terms of products of minors, so you just immediately get that the products of minors are a Grobner basis for the symbolic power. And actually, just more generally, as soon as you prove that you have a term war that's delightful, and you know that the initial ideal is the edge ideal of a green graph, you just automatically get the Grobner basis and description of the secant ideals of the symbolic powers of those secant ideals. So this strategy works in a number of sort of classical, but also some kind of new cases as well. So. So these are all the instances where I know that it works. Generic matrix, symmetric, Boffians, Hankel, scrolls, and this funny block Hankel structure. Anyway, so it works in lots of kind of many interesting but sort of classical determinantal cases, and also the latter versions of these things. Okay, so what do I want to do in my last 5 minutes? So all right. So now I just want to say that everything I've talked about was about actually getting the generators for the ideal, but you can use this kind of technique to prove things about dimensions of secant ideals. Even though you can't get the ideal itself, you can still say, well, the dimension of the secant variety is bounded below by certain numbers. And in the particular case where this works relatively well is the case of toric varieties. And so the setup here is you have this configuration of vectors in n-dimensional space that defines your toric variety, the set of lattice points in a polytope in the way Jessica set it up. That gives you some toric variety, which I call XA. Now, it's known, the theorem of Sternfeld says that the radicals of the initial ideals of the toric ideal, those are square-free monomial ideals, so they correspond to simplicial complexes, and those simplicial complexes are always the regular triangulations of this point configuration. So the point is, you could try to use triangulations of the point configurations to prove something about the dimensions of secant varieties. So let me sort of explain how this works quickly. Pardon? Oh, sorry. All right. So, the idea is this. Well, because you have this containment that comes from the Seamus-Ulrich result, any time you have a containment of ideals, you get the inequality of dimensions. So if you can bound if you can say prove that the dimension of the secant of the initial ideal is the expected dimension, then you've proven that the dimension of the secant variety is also the expected dimension. Okay, and well, of course, the dimension only depends on the radical. So I can just focus on the simplicial complex, and then since for these toric ideals, that simplicial complex is a triangulation, this is going to say something about finding special simplices and special triangulation. So the sort of, this is, I don't know, relatively straightforward, but I don't know why I call it a theorem. It should just be proposition. But if you have a triangulation and you have a bunch of maximal simplices in the triangulation, and you look at the cardinality of the union of those maximal simplices, then that's a lower bound for the dimension of the secant ideal. That's implied by everything at the top. And in particular, if you find a bunch of simplices that are pairwise disjoint, then you know that the secant ideal has the expected dimension. So, for example, if you wanted to, say, prove that the secant ideals of the Veronese embedding, the six-uple pair Veronese embedding of P2, they all have expected dimension. Well, you just draw this triangulation, and then I've found a bunch of simplices that are disjoint. So all the up to the ninth order secant varieties all have the expected dimension, and then there's just one point that's left out, so everything else has the expected dimension too. And just let me put up this one last picture. You could try to prove, you know, it's sort of hard to do these triangulations in higher dimensions, but really we should be addressing these problems to triangulation experts. But you know, I was able to say do this sort of classical case of, you know, what Veronese surfaces have the right dimension, and it reduces to a tiling problem of tiling these tableau-shaped regions with little tetrominoes. You show that you can tile it the right, you can tile it and actually cover the whole thing or leave out one point, then it will have the expected dimension. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you for your attention. Yeah. Reminds you of a. I'm not familiar with that. But I don't know. Maybe there's some kind of connection. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty cool, huh? Yeah, that's pretty surprised that you have all that. You can do all that. You are still mic. Hello?
I couldn't really tell that I was.